Chris Rutherglen from the Gold Investor Research Substack. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for having me back.
Always a pleasure to speak with you, Chris. You know, you come at this research, very, very deep research, from such a, I don't want to say a technical perspective, but of course you are an engineer. You look at things very systematically. And, you know, as an engineer math mind, I can absolutely appreciate that. So why don't we start by framing today's discussion by discussing what your ultimate gold and silver targets are, what the time frame for those targets are, and from there we can kind of walk backwards through a very data-driven, fundamental and technical argument for how you have come up with those targets.
Okay, sure. Let me bring up some charts to help out. Here's the sequence of events that we've had thus far. I get the details on all of this a little bit later. Let me go to this one. So in terms of what I think is next, as a sort of a sneak peek of what's to come as we get into more detail on how we get to these targets, I'm thinking that based on how things are going, the cycles are going to continue. The gold price is still going to go up because the indicators that would suggest otherwise suggest that the top is imminent or has already occurred are just not there yet. None of the indicators. So in which case is probably going to go higher. And the target I'm looking at right now for the next sort of intermediate cycle or next leg up for the gold price, which probably be later than the year from summer to October, but definitely before the midterm elections, would be like in the mid 6,000 range. So maybe 6,500, 6,700, roughly around there. So that's for gold. That's kind of where I'm thinking it's going to be, because it looks like we're going to have at least one more advancing move. If you go to for silver, silver, the target is probably around 175 plus or minus some amount.
Time frames, just for those that are listening on audio, is July to October 26.
July to October, that's right. Yeah, so sometime in the summer, maybe October, but definitely before the midterm elections is kind of what I'm looking at. So that's the timing. Now, if we look for silver, just a quick note on that. So this, you know, price recently went over $100 an ounce. And if you scale that back and you take out the embedded inflation that has been sort of accumulating in it over time, that price is essentially the same price level as the $50 we saw in 2011. And then this plot right here is sort of showing these levels as they sort of progress through time. To the extent that one would say that the 2011 peak was a bubble, well, maybe, maybe not, but it's still not that. It still has more room to go. It's like, it's not the $50 from 1980. So the $50 from 1980, we can use this chart here and look at it, either in the linear or the log plot. Mm-hmm. And you sort of scale that forward, that $50 1980 would be about 350 right now. So we're still far away from that level. But nevertheless, it is high from a cyclical point of view. But based on, you know, how things go, when the cycle is in an uptrend, it could continue to go higher. And that's basically what the data is suggesting, that it's going to continue to go higher. So
sorry to interrupt again, Chris. For those that are listening to this on audio, this is a very chart-heavy interview. Chris put some beautiful charts together that are, again, have a lot of data within them. So, you know, I do suggest actually watching this episode.
So with that, I can go over into more detail on like the timing on where we're at within the cycle, mm-hmm. and give a little broader framework. If that's okay, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris.
All right, let's do that. Yeah. So where we're at in the cycle. So, well, like the quickest way to really get to capture of it, at least on the first order level, is to use the Fed funds rate and that cyclical pattern to it as a method to sort of get a quick view of where you're at. So what I'm showing here on the top is the Fed funds rate, and you also have the two-year yield. And the Fed funds rate, as Jeff Gundlach likes to say, is that the Fed follows the two-year. So I have that here, so I just give a little more resolution on where things are at. That's one thing. And then on the bottom, we have the gold price. And you can see the gold price goes through these sequences of consolidation advances and consolidation advances and so forth. Now you can time those essentially with the Fed funds cycle, particularly on the when it's declining, the declining phase of that cycle. So if we start at the 2008 peak, the yields reach their high. This is a 10-year yield or the 2-year yield. They both sort of reach their peak around the same time. Then typically you're going to have the Fed start cutting rates. And around that, where we're cutting rates in the sequence of events, typically that's around the price when the gold breaks out of a consolidation pattern and it begins in an advance. And during that period, it continues to advance. And until some way midway through that rate cutting sequence, you get a local high for the gold price. And usually when the cutting sequences happen, they're cutting for a reason. They're cutting because they see a slowing economy. They're trying to stimulate things, but eventually it catches up and you get from sort of a mild or the beginning stage of recession to a sort of a deep, much more impactful part of the recession where asset prices are falling, the economy is suffering, unemployment's going up. So you can sort of break up that sequence into two, the first half and then the second half. So in the first half, the gold does well. In the second half, it doesn't do as well. It usually drops into a low. And you can see that for each of these interest rate sequences, interest rate cycles, not just in the current bull market for gold from 2000 to present, but also you can see that in the 1970s as well. And I'll show a chart that has that as well. So in the case of 2008, it reached its high in March. And what we've we what we can you can bracket these things as like a rate cut period when it's going up, and then there's another period. So basically, the gold price continues or hits a high, then it goes down, and you hit that point where, there's in this case there's a global financial crisis, the Federal Reserve and U.S. government step in the or in, maybe other central banks and governments as well do it, but they come in. And then they'll do some stimulus, whether it's quantitative easing, what have you, to I guess re-energize the economy. And then you get this second period where the gold price does well. And I would call that the QE period. So you have the rate cut period when rates are falling and that's driving the gold price higher. And then you have this QE period when you get that second boost. And each time we have these interest rate cycles, that seems to be the sequence of events in the modern time, meaning from 2000 to present. And then you go fast forward to that mini interest rate cycle in around 2000. So the gold breaks out, it reaches its high in March 2020, then it reaches its low in like a week later, and things were really accelerated in that cycle because of the COVID shutdowns of the economy. So everything was a little bit artificial in that sense. But nevertheless, it still had that same sequence where you get a high, a low, then you get the stimulus, and you get that second QE period. So that brings us to the present where we're at right now. So we have the in March 2024, the gold price broke out, and then it began its advance. And we've been in that for, it's going on almost 2 years now. So this cycle is definitely longer and more stretched out than the prior two. And that's perhaps helping the gold price continue to just go up and up higher. But we are getting closer. We're definitely closer to that midway point than we were, say, a year ago. So that's sort of the big picture view of where we're at, but it doesn't say we're actually at the top. We're at near the peak yet, because there's other indicators that give a little higher resolution. But for this, it's just saying that you probably want to be at sort of like an orange level of risk, as opposed to green, where there's low risk, and then red would be like it's very high risk that we're at that point, but we're not quite there yet. So that's one way to look at it.
How does, Trump bringing in a new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, that has been presented as somebody that is going to be hawkish? So how do we know that we are going to, let's say, enter another QE cycle, which includes, currency printing and interest rate cutting?
Well, I think with it doesn't matter who the Federal Reserve person is I know that's how they're framing it, and I think that's just for narrative purposes, because typically when these things happen, what they say and what ends up happening is not the same thing. In fact, I can bring up a different chart here, and this is basically looking at the money supply. So we just went through a and it, so I let me so it was, this is looking at the money supply changing year to year, and and that's the black line here is that's how the money supply. So it goes up during the COVID shutdown and that stimulus that followed it, and then you have a QE periods, and you might have QE1, 2, 3. And what I've also have here is these different sort of components that would help drive the money supply. So typically when bank credit goes up, that's going to increase the M2 money supply because it increases bank deposits, commercial bank deposits. Or if the Federal Reserve is buying and a reserve, the bank reserves are increasing at the central bank, then that's going to cause it. So I bring this up just to show that we just had a QT period where the quantitative tightening. So although they were tightening, they said that was the narrative that was going out. We're going to be tightening the money supply, but while they were doing that, while they were tightening, they were also releasing money from the reverse repo purchase, the reverse repo facility. And essentially that what that does is it's taking QE quantitative easing or money printing that had happened in the past, and then they have sort of squirreled it away by bringing it back in, and then now they're releasing at the same time that they're doing quantitative tightening. So in a sense, those two factors just offset each other. So you can see, although they're tightening, there's some other things going on. And in 2024, you see they're tightening here, but you have bank credit increasing and the reverse repo is also contributing. So it was actually an up year for money supply, even though they were supposedly on a tightening mode.
I
So
think
the reason I just bring this up is that what they say and how it ends up, it's like a bait and switch, or look here, but I'm going to do this like a magician. I would look at it more of in through that lens. It's narrative, but it's not going to be substance.
Well, and just thinking about this as I was writing notes for today, it would be a perfect narrative to establish that we're going to bring in a fiscal hawk. And if we continue with the rate cutting cycle, that must mean we really need it if Kevin Warsh ends up, being or continuing the rate cutting cycle, right? And the QE cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I find it odd that, I mean, he would put someone in who's going to be a hawk when he's complaining or criticizing the current Fed chairman that he's not cutting interest rates enough and not being ease has enough ease. So I think it's more for narratives only. But when it comes down to it, if the economy gets bad, they're gonna do what they always do. If the banks are in trouble, they're going to definitely do what they always do. So I think that's what it comes down to. It's more for public consumption, public narrative, to get people to think that, oh, it's a change in direction. This time we're serious. This time we're really going to tighten the belt on all this stuff. And I suspect that's not going to be the case. Yeah. So here's the one of the indicators that's also helpful for identifying when the gold price is about to reach a high. That's what we're kind of looking at. We're trying to figure out the timing. When is it coming? And then we'll look at the level. So on the timing, one of the other indicators is the stock market itself. So the S&P 500, if you look at it, tends to be a leading indicator. So typically what happens is it reaches a peak first during this rate cutting phase. It reaches its peak first and then declines. And then sometime after that, when it's already in that declining phase, then the gold price reaches its own respective peak. So in that sense, you have an early indicator. Now we can see this going back to the 1970s. So we have a 19 around 1974, the gold price reached a peak. Well, first, you can say that the Fed funds rate reached the peak in July 1974 at 14%. It's obviously much higher than what we're seeing today at like was it like four or 3.625%. So it reached the peak there. Then the S&P 500 actually, I think, peaked maybe like a year before that, and it had been in a declining phase. So what I'm showing here, I should back up and tell what I'm pointing to here. So this is the S&P 500 normalized to its 3-year moving average. So basically, it's looking at how the S&P 500 is moving up and down as a cycle around that moving average. And it's an easier way to frame it as opposed to look at the log chart and see it and squint your eyes and pick it out. So if you look at this, so basically the S&P reaches its peak, and then the gold price reaches its peak when the whole thing, or it already declined quite a bit. It's actually at the lows. And that happened to be around 8.6% on the Fed funds rate. So it went from 14 to 8.6, and ultimately went down to 5%. So again, we see that around the midway point is when the gold price tends to have the maximum benefit. And we can get into in a subsequent slide on why that is, why does it tends to happen around that point. But just for now, just looking at this indicator, the stock indicator. So that's then. So we can go forward to the interest rate cycle around 2008 peak. So again, we have the S&P reaches its high. In this case, it was around October 2007. Then it starts declining. The gold price reaches its peak in March, so a few months later in March 2008. And then it continued down until almost like a year later in March 2009 due to the global financial crisis and what have you. And then you see the exact same pattern if you look at around the interest rate cycle around the COVID-19 shutdowns, where you have the S&P reach a peak, gold reaches a peak a little bit after it, and then everything sort of falls apart, and then gold price goes down too. So where we're at right now, so basically the template what we're looking for is we need to see the S&P 500 in the or the stocks in general in a declining phase. Now, in the recent history suggests that that declining phase is likely to go all the way down to the 3-year moving average, and then around there you should be more on the lookout for a gold cycle high or rate cut period cycle high. But we're not even there. It's not even in the declining phase yet, so it's hard to make the case that it's about to roll over right now when this indicator is not there. So that's one way to look at it. Another is the bond market. So obviously there's stocks, bonds, and then commodities, I guess. So it turns out that well, I guess everyone really knows that real yields are there's a strong correlation between gold and the inverse real yields. So if you plot the inverse of it, they tend to do the opposite. So here what we're going to plot is we have the gold price on top, and on the bottom is the 10-year real yield. And basically what I'm showing here is that the gold price tends to do best, not surprisingly, when real yields are declining and tends to reach its maximum point when real yields are at their maximum negative value. And that's exactly what you saw in December 1974 at that peak. The exact point when gold reaches its high was when the real yields were the most negative. And for plotting this, it's just the 10-year nominal yield. And then subtracting off the CPI inflation rate and then a small adjustment in the denominator. So you see that pattern where you have the declining phase. So you have declining real yields, and then you get the peak at the maximum point. And you see the exact same thing in 1980, in January 1980, where it goes negative, reaches a low, comes back, or then the gold price reaches its high at the same time. You get a little dip, and then there's another sort of wave down and almost like a double top, but although it didn't quite get up the same level for gold as the 10-year real yield reached the new low, and then it was sort of up from there. So basically you see a consistent pattern, and if you go forward to the plot the exact same stuff but for the current period from 2000 to present, you look at the March 2008, you see declining yields, real yields, and it goes negative around the time of the peak. And then again around the September 2011 peak. It's sort of hovering around just under 2%, and then it drops down to almost negative 2% into that high, and then from there it starts to go up. So you almost talk to, if you had the data real time, you could sort of have a real good gauge on when things are happening. But in that case, this low tick on this real yield was exactly at that in September of 2011, just as that was peaking. And then you can fast forward to the peak in March 2020, and you see a similar pattern where it's declining and it reaches its low just as the gold price is reaching its high. So if we look now where we're at currently, the 10-year real yield is still sort of hovering just below plus 2%. So it hasn't even begun to decline yet. So maybe it's going to be something like in 2011, where it sort of hovers just below 2%. And then in the last few months, it just sort of declines. And you get that low. So this is another indicator. So when you see this one start to come down and maybe go to zero or below zero, then you know you're getting much closer. But right now it's still, near 2%. So it's again not indicating much. So to get the real yields to go lower, there's one of two ways that it can happen. Either you can get the 10-year nominal yield to go down, or you can get inflation, the CPI inflation, to go up. In the recent history, it's mainly been the getting the 10-year yield to go up, or sorry, the 10-year yield to go down. 10-year yield goes down, then it's going to cause the real yields to go down. And here's a way we can see that in terms of the 10-year yield. The 10-year yield is plotted inversely, so it's actually, so when it's a high, that's actually a low, and on this axis is the futures price. So when the price of the bond goes up, means the yields are going down. So we're just sort of plotting it sort of in that way right here. But you see in March 17th, 2008, as gold reaching its high, so was the 10-year T, futures price. And then March 9th, 2020, similarly, it reached its high, coincident with that of with the 10-year T-note futures price. Or another way to say this, when the 10-year yield reached its low.
Chris,
So go ahead.
sorry, what I was going to ask is, you look at many of these different correlations here, and it does seem that, let's say, the nature of the gold market seems to be changing. Have you found any of these correlations have started to break down over their, let's say, historic predictive pattern or predictive value that they've had?
So far, not really, but maybe things will change. But I'm basically just going off the cycles and what has happened in the past. So in the 70s, it was really inflationary period. Current period is somewhat inflationary. You get these waves of inflation, but it's not as compressed and as high a magnitude of inflation as the 1970s. It may sort of stretch the bounds of the historical precedents, but since that's the only thing I have to guide the analysis, that's kind of what I use. And since it typically occurs in it's sort of a, I guess the best starting point one could use. But yeah, I am on the lookout for, are things changing, and what impact that could have on things. So there's always that possibility, but as they say in finance, it's usually not a good idea to bet on this time is different. But usually, when you think it's this time is different, then it turns out it's actually the same, and you may have had it reacted differently had you had taken that opinion. So
What's
I think I
the
would say that, yeah.
I was going to say, what's the line? Past performance isn't a predictor of future returns.
So, continue on with this. So we can zoom in and look at those different periods in a little more detail. So 2008, you can see it sort of channeling, reaching a high, and then comes off low. The gold price reaches its high at this point. So we're looking at March 17, 2008. Similarly for the 2020 period, March 9th, 2020. Again, we have the the 10-year T-note futures price reaching its high. And here we are in 2026 now, and it's not at a high. It's sort of at the bottom rail of this channel. And interestingly, if you go back and look at all this, for some reason, the seasonality seems to suggest that around the turn of the year, January 1st, I'm plot showing here, that it tends to touch the bottom rail of the channel. So you see that in both these instances, in 2008 and 2020, it's around that start of the year, it's at the bottom. And then, right now we're at that same point. Whether this is all coincidence or there's a seasonality, I don't know. But nevertheless, one would expect it probably, if the economy is going down and things are not doing well, then, or particularly if the stock market's going down, the money's going to go somewhere. And the gold market's only going to capture so much because some investors and some market participants, either for regulatory reasons or because of their mandates, they're not going to be investing that much in the precious metals. But bonds are still an option. So you could get a flight to safety, if you will, into bonds. And if it were to happen, it would reach this top rail around this level right here. That would be essentially around a 3.5% yield on a 10-year. Now, I heard a recent interview with David Rosenberg, and he mentioned that he also said at the end of the year he's thinking that it's going to be around 3.5% to 10 years. So I'm not sure if he's looking at the same thing, but there's an I guess w w at least one more or w at least one other analyst who's thinking that that's it, the 10-year yield is likely to go lower in yield, yeah, higher in price. So this is all speaking to just the timing. So basically to say that we're not quite there yet, but here's some signs to look for when you're getting close. I guess the next question, unless you have something to interject, I can go over to just the levels, which in more detail. So we touched on what those ultimate targets would be, but we can get a little more granular on it,
The
unless
only
you have a different
thing I was going
question.
to add was that the Fed doesn't have control over the 10-year, right? It's the overnight rate that they have control over, but the market basically prices the 10-year for the most part. Obviously, they have some influence over it, but it's not like they can set the 10-year where they want.
That's right. In fact, there's a plot that I've or a relationship that I've found recently that sort of speaks to that point. It also gives them some bounds on what could be possible, the maximum extent. So this is looking at the 10-year. So I guess everyone's known that there's a relationship between the 10-year T-note yield and the U.S. GDP, where that if economy's growing really strongly, then the yield tends to go up, and when it's not, then the yield goes down. So there's a relationship here. So that's a plot at the bottom here in red. This dashed line is the 10-year T-note yield. And then in shaded gray is the year-on-year change in the US GDP. So you can see that the two roughly follow each other. So when GDP is up, yields go up, and when they go down, so forth. And on the top, what I'm plotting is the difference. So it's the yields track the change in GDP. And sort of during what it looks like to me is like during the 70s, during these inflationary periods, the yield tends to be less than the growth in the GDP. So during the late part of the 70s, it was about 3.1% less than the GDP growth rate at that time. And then you get into the 80s and 90s, then it's above it. So it's not an inflationary period, it's more of a deflation or a disinflationary period. But then you get back into around, early 2000s, then it goes back to that mode again where it's trading at less than GDP, the 10-year yield. So in some sense, you can think of this as a cap. So if you can say, well, the GDP is going to grow at 4 or 5%, then most likely the 10-year yield is going to be less than that. How much less? Well, you can sort of rough it by basically looking at the average. So from say 2010 to 2020, it was averaging 1.7% less than the GDP growth rate. So if GDP growth rate's around 5%, then 1.7% less than that is 4.3. So that's not too far off of where it's at right now. In fact, I think that's exactly where it's at. It's around 4.3% today, the 10-year yield. So in which case, so if one's going to say that the 10-year yield is going to go to 8%, then one would have to think that the GDP is going to have to go high. Maybe it's not to say it's through normal or real growth. This could be just inflationary growth, but yeah. So moving on to the levels. So one of the methods that is useful to framing the gold price throughout history or throughout time is looking at the what I call the mid-cycle level. And essentially what this is taking some historical price in the past and then projecting it forwards and backwards in time. And then using a scaling relationship that uses the money supply to capture the embedded inflation that's in the gold price or in any price. But since we're looking at the gold price, we'll just pick that. And then you just sort of take it from one of these where the like a midway point, like for example, you have the 1980 high, and then you have the 2020 low. So midway through there, you can sort of pick a point and then you can use that and then draw this line out and scale it forward. So what this does is it gives you two parts. So it says there's a trending component to the gold price that's set by the embedded inflation through the money supply increases. And there's a cyclical component that overrides it. And you can see it's well above the current mid-cycle level. Now we can sort of extract that cyclical component by just dividing the gold price divided by the mid-cycle level. So in a sense, it's kind of like flattening the gold price. So we're not looking at a trending that goes up into the right. Now it's
Just
just
kind
sort
of
of flat
smoothing
because
it.
we flattened it. So if you do that, this is what it looks like. You get these ups and then downs, ups and downs, and ups and downs. So this just gives you a way to really see from a cyclical point of view how far we swung above the trend. And right now it's starting to rival that of the 1980 peak. Because we can see it's already went above the 2011. It's above the one from 1934. So there's only one left, and it's this one. So, the utility of this is not just in seeing the cycle, but it's also in terms of identifying levels. But it for some reason, and this is just an empirical observation as opposed to I have a deep understanding of why. But if you look at the data, there tends to be these recurring levels where price goes up to it, this normalized mid-cycle level, and then it reaches a resistance, if you will. So it is one we can particularly focus on this 1.38 multiple of the mid-cycle level, where you see it getting hit in the 19 ni December 1974 peak, and then again in the mid to late 1980s. Then we have the 2008, March 2008. It reached that same level, and then again in August of 2020, and then now we're sort of off to, where it's at new highs, just keep breaking up and up and up. So at this point, there's really only one more level to hit, and that's this level that we saw with the cyclical peak in 1980, and it's at 3.85% or 3.85x multiple of the gold's mid-cycle level, and that if you were to plot it out is around the 6,500, 6,700, depending on where we're at that time. Here's another look at it where you can see it in a little more detail, each of these sequence of events as I've gone through it. So this is looking at the past five intermediate cycles where it goes up, and you can see it sort of reacting and constrained by some of these levels. The interesting thing is you can do this sort of methodology for looking at the gold price by normalizing it. Not just using the mid-cycle level, but other methods. So I think Michael Oliver does something similar to this, where he's looking at just the monthlies. In this case, I'm just using the daily stuff and just normalizing to the 3-year moving average. And by doing this, what you can see is that you can also get sort of comparable levels that sort of stick out in terms of where you're at. So in 2006, 2008, and 2011, there was sort of a common level that it went to, and this is basically the swing above the 3-year moving average, and you can find other ones in there as well. But the interesting thing, what you could do is when you sort of combine this with take all these levels and then sort of map them back onto the price chart, then you could sort of see how they're interplaying with each other. So this is kind of a busy chart, but I guess the main thing to look at. So wait, the green is these recurring levels from the 3-year moving average, and then the blue are from the mid-cycle level. And you can sort of see it sort of constrained here, and it bounces up. And tends to be it tends to be where they intersect. These green and blue lines intersect. You tend to get like crossings where the gold price tends to go to it or punches through it. So in this case, like in last year, around October of last year, we set our targets around this level. This is around the 4,000, and it ended up going above it, and then came back down into it and consolidated within that sort of intersecting that crossing area. And then now we just had a peak where it went up to 5,600. Again, I guess the gold price overshot our target, which was around the 5,000 level, the 5,200. And that's just corresponding to this intersection point. Went above it, and now it's sort of back, it's sort of consolidating right around that level. So if you sort of look ahead on what could happen, you project some of these lines in the into the forward in time, then that's kind of we're thinking that probably by July, October is probably going to be that next period where you're going to get an intersection, and it would coincide with that top level. And that's kind of how we got how I get that this value.
And of course, you do the same projection for silver, right?
So this is again, so this is what this is looking at is the silver price, and you normalize it to the mid-cycle, gold's mid-cycle level. So the assumption here is that silver and gold are very related, and that trending component, that slow-moving trending component that the price is going to oscillate around, is probably going to be similar, maybe if not the same, between those two metals. So in which case, by dividing the silver price by gold's mid-cycle level, you're going to extract that cyclical component that overrides the trending component. And now by doing that, you can identify clearly that there's this big level that's been hit four times, well, now four times in the past. Once in 1974, then in the early 1980s, around, and then in 2011. So this is that level around, it's what I call 5.5% of gold's mid-cycle level. So this corresponded to the 1950, or sorry, the $50 peak in 2011. It corresponded to the, I have to look what the price is, but whatever the price high was in 1974, and another one here. So, or it's corresponding to the $100 price from a couple of weeks ago, or last week. So basically, based on this, we just set our target. So that's the logical target. So back in October of last year, when the gold price was, or sorry, so the silver price was in the 40s, $40 range. We said, well, at this point, there's going to be one more intermediate cycle at least, and the big target's going to be this level right here. So we set the target at 5.5%, which is where is with 80, 84 to 10, $84 to 101, $101, and it actually went past it, and it went up to the, it actually went up to the next up, recurring support resistance zone at 7% of gold's mid-cycle level. So with that said, then you say, all right, well, with if gold's already or silver price has already gone there, then what's the next up target? Well, silver tends to outperform gold late in the cycle, late in the rate cut period cycle. So it's not going to be a small move, it's going to be another big move. And there's not many more targets remaining. The next one up after you get past 7.5, you have there's this 8.1215, and that would correspond to like around $37. And then the next up one is 175. So that's kind of where we're setting our target, around plus or minus some amount of from $175 as a target for silver. Now there is this one way up here corresponding to that 350. Now there are some analysts who are calling for targets even higher than 350, but That would be quite a move from where it's at right now in the 70s, 80s price.
And
That's probably a 300%. Yeah, it's very big.
that's basically projected forward from the 1980 high.
That's right. Yeah. And basically it's really this, if one uses this as an analytical tool to decipher where these potential highs could be, there's only two left, and it's those two. So silver is still going to do well. I know there's one analyst who's saying that, they're selling, they sold their silver, and they expect it to come down. But silver and gold follow the same path. In fact, I can just show that right here. So if you look at the silver to gold comparison between the two, when gold's up, well, we both when gold's up, silver's going to follow it up. And they tend to reach their peak around the same time, in which case, if gold still has more room to run, then that means silver has more room to run. Well, that's pretty much the takeaway message from this.
Obviously, we're talking about, in some ways, a relatively short-term target here for this next intermediate top. What do you think comes after that from a, let's say, taking it from two sides, an economic perspective and or a metals price perspective?
Yeah. So I think the first hint of what comes after that is just follow the sequence. So we have this rate cut period, which we're currently in, and then you have this QE period. So typically the sequence of events that typically play out that I have in mind is that, we continue the rate cuts. Eventually you have there's some event and the economy goes into recession and markets become under heavy pressure. The result of which Federal Reserve and the US government do a massive stimulus of some sort. Now, what causes that is the big question mark. Is it some black swan event? Is it something to do with is it a war? Is it stock market crashes or something like that? Or is it the bond market? They can't finance things. Something's going to happen.
In this case, it might be the midterms.
It could be the midterms. Yeah, so the midterms I think is important just because the chances of Trump and the Republicans winning are very, very low, which case the Democrats take over, and then the smooth sailing that they think that they have in terms of doing stimulus, doing this, doing that, is going to be is they're basically on a really tight leash, and they may not be able to get much done at that point. In which case, they basically have up until that point to do all this stimulus to try to win the election or what have you. But after that, I think that's sort of the turning point. So that's kind of why I'm thinking that the gold price is probably going to reach its high around that point. Because after that, if there's not doing as much stimulus, then inflation expectations will probably start to come down too. And that's actually an interesting thing. I should probably bring that up. So what is the current gold price, which is sort of unprecedentedly high at 5,000, just under 5,000 or around 5,000 level. What is that telling us? So there's a way you can look at the gold price and not just as at a price, but you can actually look at it as an inflation expectation. And this is just using the relationship between real gold price and real yields. So if you do that and you plot it out, what you end up getting is in gold right here. What I'm showing is the gold-based inflation expectation. So in the same way that one could sort of take an inflation expectation out of the 10-year TIPS or any of the Treasury inflation protected securities, you can sort of extract that. Well, by just doing a little bit of math, you can do the same thing with the gold price. And you can see that it does follow it. So in the 1970s, the gold price sort of was following the CPI inflation rate, and it overshot it at the end and reached up to almost 19% was the inflation rate that the gold price was pricing, or the gold was pricing in at that high, which was well above the CPI inflation rate, which was probably closer to maybe 14, 15%. And then it took 2 decades for those two numbers to reconverge. That is the gold inflation expectation and the CPI rate. Now, if you go to the current period, from 2000 to present, well, I guess you also get a during this period, we also get a new inflation measure, which is the TIPS, the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities break-even inflation rate. So during the early 2000s, you see that all three of those measures were trending together, and then they diverged around 2005, coincident with a spike in inflation, and it sort of stayed up there for a while, and then reconverged again around 2022, 2023, and then diverged in 2024 as the gold price started to go up. Maybe it was 2023 when this happened. But nevertheless, so where is it at right now? So basically, gold's pricing in a 10% inflation expectation, which is much higher than the CPI or even what the bond market is pricing in. So what does that say? Is it so if that says if over say next 20 years, if inflation's 10% over that whole span of period of time, it's basically saying it's a pricing in. Say like if eggs cost $5 now per carton, then maybe $40, and by 2050 would be the expectation based on this. Now, whether that's true or not, maybe it is, maybe not. But that's just what is pricing in, which is quite high inflation expectations. So it is already priced quite high, and but the thing is, it could go a little bit higher before it comes down. But there is plenty of room for it to come back lower, because it is getting ahead of itself in terms of inflation expectations.
Chris, during the last week of January there, we saw massive volatility, almost crypto-like volatility in both gold and silver. You know, gold is supposed to be a boring pet rock that, you know, does appreciate over time, especially considering inflation and stuff. How does that volatility fit into your framework and your analysis? And do you have an idea of where those bottoms come in a pullback like that?
I guess for the volatility, when you get near the end, you get a lot bumpier ride. Roller coasters become a little more white knuckly. And for me, I'm using these levels to help understand where we're at and where potentially go. Now, typically, once you reach the peak in the gold price, whether it's the 2006, 2008, or 2011, or currently, you tend to get much deeper retraces where the downside volatility is a lot higher. And the fact that we haven't got that yet suggests that it's still room to run to the upside. So this is like a negative indicator one would look at, in the sense that you're inverting it instead of looking at what does occur, what doesn't occur. Before, while it's still advancing. But conversely, what does occur when it's in the declining phase? And then we can see right here in the 2025-26 period that we tend to get these shallow retraces where it doesn't really pierce through these different leveled support zones. In the past, you would see it at least pierce through one or maybe even two of them. In this case, it pierced through two of them. So a deep retrace events. And when you start to see deep retraces, then that's probably we're getting near the end. But yeah, in terms of volatility, it's probably going to continue to stay high just because now there's more attention in it into the gold market. The price has gone up. It's attracted more short-term buyers. And I think that's just how it's going to go until the very end, until maybe there's like a blow off. Move at the top.
So, exactly as you're saying there, Chris, when we, where do you, or do you have a particular time frame where you do expect this, like, let's say, ultimate blow off type top that maybe lasts for another decade or two?
Let's see. Yeah, let's see. I think the best thing to do is look at the QE period. So how long that tends to last. So once we get the low, so the expectation is the gold price is going to probably reach a high, and then it's going to come down, reach a low, and And then we're going to have that QE period. So that would start when they start the next major round of quantitative easing. In fact, one could time their purchases around that point when they announce that. Now, if we look, try to think about what that higher price level could be and how long it could take, we could let me go to this chart right here. So here's what we're looking at is we're looking at the all sector debt to U.S. money supply ratio in the U.S. from 1920 to present. So you can see from 1920 to 1980, it was fairly consistently oscillating around the 2.5 times. So the debt was 2.5 times greater than the money supply. And then it ran in the late 70s, then it started to go up. Then it trended up until it reached around 7x, and then now it's been trending down. So what's causing it to go down is that the money supply is now increasing quicker than the debt is. Now we had a recent, there was a hiccup around where it went down and back up with the quantitative easing, massive, and then the quantitative tightening. But the trend is that it's probably going to continue down until the 2030s. If you sort of just roughly eyeball this and how low it can go. Now, if we say, well, if it's going to go down to that, if it's going to come back to that equilibrium level from the past of 2.5x, one could use this data point to figure out what could be the gold price at that point. And to do that, you just sort of continue this lower. And if you assume a 5% increase in the debt each year, what would the money supply need to be for this ratio to return to that 2.5x level? And it turns out it's roughly, depending on the assumptions used, around $60 trillion by, say, the mid-2030s. Right now, the money supply is around $22 trillion. So that's almost a 3x of the money supply. And that would do it. So by relating it back to the money supply, what we can then do is figure out what the gold price would be, because we have a relationship between the money supply and the gold price, as we mentioned here, where this mid-cycle level is going to scale with the money supply. So shown at the top here is the mid-cycle level. So if it continues up because the money supply is increasing, then we can use that point. So if we look at this chart here, we can sort of roughly define a channel. And if you project it forward, it would say that the top of the channel is going to be around 6 to 7x multiple of the gold's mid-cycle level. Now, by figuring out what the mid-cycle level is from this, so if you have $60 trillion in the future, that would sort of translate to a gold price of, or a gold mid-cycle level of $4,000 an ounce. So $4,000 an ounce times 6 or 7 is going to be $24,000. And that's kind of how I got that. So 6 times 4 is 24. So 24,000. So that's kind of a rough way to gauge of how high things could go if things play out like this. Now, obviously, there's a lot of assumptions that went into this, and sort of forward looking by at least a decade, 10 years. So it could be off by some amount and things could change, but the framework that one could use is to arrive at something, arrive at any target that's sort of somewhat analytically based is this, and you get that 24,000. And as for silver, you can do a similar exercise, and you can just use, if you have $4,000 as your gold's mid-cycle level, then you multiply that by this, and say the silver price reaches that same cyclical high that it did in 1980, which was 21% of gold's mid-cycle level. So you do 0.21 times 4,000, and that comes around $840 per ounce for silver as a top tick. So that's, I guess it's not as extravagant of a price as it was like 6 months ago when the gold price was, less than 50. Now that we've already seen 100 and 117. But nevertheless, that's one way one can analytically look at this and figure out what possible high targets are.
Zooming back in a little bit, Chris, do you think that commitment of traders reports are a reasonable indication of, let's say, price direction towards those delivery dates?
So maybe not for this long stuff yet. The utility I find out of the commitment of traders report is the following. So the managed money traders, what they tend to do is they tend to be momentum based traders, and they tend to increase their positioning as the gold price rises and then decrease it as it falls. Except at certain periods of time, which is telling, they do the opposite. They actually decrease their positioning as the gold price rises. And this is sort of a useful indicator for when you're sort of approaching one of these turning points. So if we look at the current cycle, they reached around 52% of all long positions on the COMEX trading. So that's quite a heavy, they're extremely overweight their gold positioning at this point. And that was reached the high of in early 2025. So early last year, it reached a peak. And then although the gold price continued to go higher, the ratio started to fall, and now it's around 40%. So 40% of all long futures contracts are owned by the managed money traders. So it's under a declining trend. Now we can see that this is not the first time it's happened. It's happened in the past, going into both the 2008 peak and then the 2011 peak, where you see the exact same thing where it's declining as the gold price is rising. And this is another one of those early warning signs that we're getting closer to that point where things are getting near the end of the rate cut period of the cycle. So there's two parts of the cycle, there's Act One and Act Two. There's a rate cut period, which we're nearing the end of, and then there's the subsequent QE period where you get the biggest advancing moves in gold and silver. And in between those two periods is a dip in the price. And I would recommend most people, they probably want to be somewhat in cash to an extent to take advantage of the opportunities that come from that dip that historically happens. And if one thinks history is a potential guide to the future, then it's probably likely to happen again. So this is the utility that I get out of the commitment of traders report, is something like this.
Perfect. Chris, is there anything else that you think is useful to understand the context of, let's say, this time that we're in?
I think there is one more thing, and that's related to the mining stocks. And the tendency is, because of, I think, technical analysis tends to be the main tool used by many analysts, that they miss some fundamental things by just sort of doing the quick way to plot things. So you quite often see where a gold mining stock, or most likely an index, say the GDX, is take they take a you take a ratio of that to the gold price itself, and then they say it's undervalued because, look, the ratio, it was stable around at some higher level, and now it's down this lower channel, and it's just there's a big room to catch up. The flaw in this way of looking at it, when you just do a straight share price or index, mining index divided by the gold price, is that it fails to account for that the amount of gold that the company was producing. In this case, is Newmont, but you can do it with the index as well, because that's, one of the major components of the index. Is not the same amount. They're producing a different amount of gold, so you're essentially buying a different stream of gold production, whether you is in 2005 or present. And then we can see that if I go ahead. So what I'm plotting here is for Newmont. So if you just did that sort of straightforward Newmont share price divided by the gold price, you would get a chart that looks like this. Yeah, if you did this with the GDX index, you would get this a similar looking chart where you have this. It looks like, wow, when it breaks out of this, it's just going to run all the way up to here and get back to old equilibrium level, right? But that's the wrong way to look at it. And the flaw is that the production between back then and today is not the same. So back in 2005, for Newmont, it was producing around 25 ounces of gold per 1,000 shares. And if you fast forward that today, it's producing just over five. So it's gone down by five. So it's decreased by a substantial amount. So there's no reason to think that just because the name, the ticker symbol is the same, that one's going to want to pay the same price that they did for 25 ounces of gold per unit, which is 1,000 shares. They're not going to want to pay the same amount today. They're going to want to pay the same amount if you sort of, if you correct for that change in production. When you do that, you go back to this chart. You see, it's just within the channel, so it's right in the middle of the channel. So there's no big jump up it's going to do. It's just above the midpoint and go a little higher. Maybe go overshoot a little bit because you know the this is just looking at sort of a first order. Almost like a price to sales valuation metric. If one wanted to get more detail, you would look at a cash flow perspective. But nevertheless, it's just it. There's a flaw in that way of looking at it. And I would just caution people who are viewing this or seeing other people present charts like that. They should understand that it doesn't work. It only works in rare cases where the production profile is constant over time. Now there is a few cases where it is constant over time, and one is Agnico Eagle. So if you look at their production profile over the past 15 years, it is pretty much flat, as you see here. It's around 7 ounces of gold production per unit, per 1,000 shares, and you can plot the same channel. But when you look at the big companies, we just looked at Newmont, but if you look at Barrick, it has the same problem as Newmont had, where in this case, it was at 10 ounces of gold production. And now it's down just over two. So it's a big drop in production per share. So it's not the, it just one wants to be cautious. One company that is still low, so I look at a lot of the larger companies in terms of their production, or the ones that have the large market cap, so over $1 billion. And if you look at their market cap to revenue ratio, or what I call the instantaneous price to revenue ratio, because what I'm looking at here is the current price of gold times the annualized production and getting this ratio. So I think that's the correct way to do it. If you wanted to do something similar as like a first order analysis tool. But in terms of B2 Gold, they're the only company that I could find that's actually still at the bottom of their channel. They have not gone anywhere close to the top of the channel. All the other companies are either above the midway point or at the top rail or even maybe above it in some cases. But B2 Gold, because of particular circumstances that eventually will be resolved, they have some hedging. They have a new mine in Canada that they're bringing up, and they just need to get that to a stable production profile, and then some forward sales, which will both the hedging and the forward production will just sort of run off, one mid this year and the hedging by the end of this year. So there's an opportunities to be found. And just to jump through some of these other ones, like here's First Majestic Silver. It's sort of tapped on the top end of its range. Alamos Gold is sort of above, it's around a six multiple. Eldorado Gold, again. So this is an analysis tool that one could use, this instantaneous price to revenue ratio, as a better metric than just using a stock price divided by an ounce of gold, whatever that price is. Yeah.
And that's not to say that they don't overshoot from time to time, but it's just, an instructive possible entry point, right?
Yeah. Well, I would say this is just like a first order analysis metric that one could look at. And then it's like, oh, is it high? Is it low? And then you can sort of dig in deeper. Because it basically it's a price to revenue ratio. And that's just one metric out of many that one could use to look at anything.
Excellent. Well, Chris, I think that's a kind of a good place to put a pin in it for today. Of course, all of this analysis, this deep analysis, if you liked Chris's charts, they're all available at GI for Gold Investor, giresearch.substack.com, and of course, on X as well, at C Rutherglen. Anything else to add, Chris?
No, I think that's it. Yeah, thank you for having me on, Tom.
It's always a pleasure, Chris. Always a deep dive into the data. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, you're welcome.